Which ones do you want to start with, I guess?
Let's start with the Coen brothers one, because I'm not going to lie, I've been amped up to do this episode for a while now.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, cool. Definitely, that's fine with me. And then, so which one of those would you like to talk about first?
Let's do it chronologically. Let's actually, it might make a bit more, it could come to think of it, considering I have far more to say about one than the other. Yeah. Let's do True Grit first and then Big Lebowski.
So I'm guessing you've got more to say about the Big Lebowski.
Oh, yes.
Okay, cool. So obviously, it's pretty easy to tell why these two films are linked. You suggested Big Lebowski, I think, for some kind of deeply personal reasons. And I just pulled True Grit out of my ass because it's by the same people and it also has... I'm just in a fucking mental blank. Jeff Bridges in both films. So, and... But very... very different characters, which I found really fascinating because, I mean, they were really different characters. And these were filmed within what, a year or two of each other?
About 12 years apart.
Oh, 12 years apart. Really? Oh, right. I thought they were quite close. Okay. So what year did True Grit come out? 2010.
No, trust me.
Yeah, that's cool. True Grit, 2010. Yep.
Yeah, Jeff Bridges doesn't age that badly, but this is only 2 years later.
Yeah. Oh, well, he's difficult to see in True Grit. You don't get to see much of his face, really, just that accent. No, you're right. It's properly 12 years. Okay, I'm completely wrong there. All right, well, let's start. So True Grit, had you seen it before I suggested it?
Well, actually, funny you should mention that, because when Hail Caesar came out a few years ago, yep. I was in this mode, in my critic writing, where if, like, a filmmaker I really liked came out with a new movie, I went back and watched all their previous movies. So yep. I have definitely seen this before, but it has been, like, 4 years since I last saw it, so...
Yeah, right.
Like,
I think I saw it when it came out, so it had been... probably nearly 10 years, and I was one of those ones where I was like, I'd almost completely forgotten it. So it was interesting to watch it again. It was like watching it for the first time again, sort of.
Yeah, and bonus, I also went back and watched the original True Grit as well, because this is technically a remake or another adaptation of the same source material.
Oh, okay. What was the original?
The the original was one of the classic John Wayne movies.
Uh-huh.
Him teaming up with Glenn Campbell. It was a bit weird, but I as much as I'm honestly still kind of getting my sea legs when it comes to westerns, like, it's still not really my genre.
Yeah.
I have to admit, like, watching the original, I got the fascination with it, but watching the Coen brothers do it is like night and day, pretty much.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Coen brothers are almost night and day with almost everything they do, just in terms of, like, their films are so them, and they're so different, I think, to most of what kind of hits the screens. Anyway, so I can imagine, because Westerns follow a pretty, a formula in a lot of ways. It did for a long time. That's how they kind of got to be what they are. And I think that the Coen brothers have always, I think they have a real fascination with this genre, because there's a lot of stuff that happens. A lot of films that they've done that have turned the whole kind of Western thing on its head, but not in a taking the piss way, just in a really kind of, like, just a different approach. Like,
and that's what makes, like, True Grit a definite, like, standout for the Coen brothers' entire filmography, because even considering they made a Western after this with The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which was part comedy, part drama, part musical, and like, in comparison, like, this might be one of the most straightforward movies that they've ever made, because there's no real, like, it's not like a Western with a mix of, you know, something else and some other thing. It's a very pure, streamlined kind of genre exercise. It's not something they do that often.
But is there a girl in the original one? Like a young...
Yes, actually.
Okay.
But it's really weird because, like, in all honesty, like, the casting of Mattie Ross is the main reason why I called this and the previous film Night and Day, because, right, how to put it, Kim Darby in the original, she felt like if Dorothy landed in Oz prison rather than the wonderful world, you know, the land of Oz. Okay. Like, she felt that out of place. Really? Whereas Hayley Steinfeld, who's probably better known nowadays for being in Pitch Perfect, this is her film debut, she is cutthroat. She's basically like the avatar of Western vengeance. It's kind of astounding, quite frankly, that she's that good at it, considering pretty much everything else she's done afterwards is not even close to this in terms of just, like, grit. For
it's an extraordinary performance, like, absolutely extraordinary. I loved her. I loved her. And, you know, sometimes you meet a character in a film and they're going along and then they start to do things and you go, oh, I don't know about that. Like, you start to kind of get annoyed with something that they've done or something that they've said. Her whole performance, her whole character arc, her whole story, everything she says, everything she does, every decision she makes in this film, I was just cheering for her. I was like, you're just like, she's so wonderful. And I think part of it is that she's strong, yes, and she's precocious, sure, but she's not afraid to, her character is not afraid to admit when she's gotten a bit out of her depth or she's a bit worried about something. You know, there's a few moments there where she becomes quite vulnerable.
Yes, and that definitely rang true with the original as well. But with that, it felt like the innocence was right at the front. Like, you almost don't even buy that someone this young could be, like, this vengeful. Whereas for Steinfeld, like, there's also the fact that, like, probably the biggest difference between the two movies is that with the original, it shifted perspectives every so often. Like, sometimes it'd follow Maddie, sometimes it'd follow Rooster Cogburn, sometimes it would follow LaBeef, which is one of the weirder things that was kept intact between movies, that pronunciation.
LaBeouf, like, yeah. I found that really odd too, and I wondered about that. So that was how they said it in the original film, is it?
Well, actually, in the original, they at first say LaBeouf, but then it's just like, oh yeah, call me LaBeef. Like, just sweep it under the rug. It's really odd.
Okay, right. That's really interesting. I'd love to know what the idea behind that was. But anyway,
like, the original would shift between the different characters, whereas with the Coen brothers take, it stays fixed on Maddie to the point where, like, even with the epilogue, it stays tied to her point of view. Because of that, like, everything that happens from, you know, the death of her father to, you know, arranging to get, you know, for Cogburn and LaBeef to basically, like, let her stay on rather than just, like, oh, she's a runaway, away with her. Right down to, like, just the image of her sleeping in a cemetery because she has no room and board. Like, that on its own is, like, Maddie personified.
Yeah,
like, that willingness to delve into, like, the literal death of her own era to get what she feels and what I could easily argue is her righteous retribution against the bastard who killed her father.
Look, I really, really enjoyed this movie. And, you know, we've been watching some quite difficult stuff lately. And so it was really, and I love the Coen brothers. Like, I've watched the majority of their back catalogue. And I haven't seen a film of theirs that I didn't like. But this one particularly, I really enjoyed. And I think it's probably not up there in their most popular across, you know, the board for other people. But for me, there was so much about it that was so wonderful, except sometimes I had to put the subtitles on because I couldn't understand what gibberish
was. Couldn't understand the frontier gibberish, which admittedly is something that the Coens themselves really wanted to stick to, like the actual linguistics of the era. That's why it's not just frontier gibberish, it's regional frontier gibberish, especially the difference between Rooster Cogburn, who was slurring so much, you'd think that there was quite a bit of liquid method acting involved.
Seriously?
And then you have LaBeouf, or Shia LaBeouf, as like the prototypical Texas Ranger who you know, Marty Robbins probably sang about a half a dozen times in his career.
Oh. Yeah, he was also very good. I really enjoyed Matt Damon's performance too. And I found it weird. I didn't know he was in it. I'd forgotten he was in it. And he came up, I was like, really, Matt Damon? Like, what the fuck? But he was great. He was great. I found him quite amusing.
Yeah, and that's honestly, like, the treatment of his character is definitely a bit different, because like, again, with the original, it would shift focuses a bit. We spent quite a bit of time with LaBeouf as the unsuccessful womanizer, let's say, whereas with this it's like the dynamic between Cogburn and LaBeouf is, well, it's basically, you know, the sheriff versus the cowboy.
I was gonna kind of say mentality. Well, legitimate old man versus kind of, you know, amateur.
And in all honesty, maybe it is because how Jeff Bridges plays the role of like this really sloshed, like not what he used to be, like the way he personifies it versus like even how well someone like John Wayne, you know, has made a career out of portraying that kind of character.
Yeah.
Just that final confrontation where it's like him versus four outlaws. It's like, yes.
I know.
Yes.
I know. No, it's a really satisfying watch because it's got all the elements of a fun movie to watch. It's there's parts of it that are quite funny. There's parts of it that are really endearing. There's some, you know, moments where you were a little bit like, you know, anxious or concerned about, you know, what was going to happen next, and then ultimately a great ending. And I loved all the characters, and particularly her. She just made it for me. I think without a strong performance there in her place, it wouldn't have worked so well. That was really good casting, and
I totally agree. In fact, it is for me, it really is the difference between Kim Darby and Hailee Steinfeld as far as like why I genuinely love this quite a bit more than the original, because her casting just makes almost too much sense, quite frankly, because she's that good at being able to play that role.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, like looking at it in retrospect, it feels like the kind of performance that careers are built off of.
Totally. Oh, totally.
Even if her career, like between Pitch Perfect and everything else is kind of like, you know, you're really good at baseball, so you're going to take up a career in golf. It kind of felt like that.
Yeah.
Like a reverse, but.
That's funny.
it really makes the film, especially when it gets to like that ending where you've got Elizabeth Marvel as the older Maddie, and like that whole epilogue is new for this film, or at the very least wasn't in the original film. And just like that, just missing, you know,
that was quite heartbreaking. I felt
That really was heartbreaking, but yeah. Especially like the way that mortality and ideas of like retribution and punishment just like whirl around everything. Mm. It takes, and like that's one of like the biggest stylistic difference between the two movies, where like the original played all of that dead straight, like most of the time westerns.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
This one is more like almost anti-western, in that it actively looks at it and questions like, what, you know, is revenge really that worthwhile a cause kind of thing?
Absolutely. And that's there. I think that's part of the Coen brothers. I mean, I can't, you know, speak for them personally, but I feel like that's part of their MO, is that they like to pull these things apart and look at particular genres or story ideas and stuff and take them apart in that way and make us think about them and look at them in a different kind of light, and that's part of what I love. I mean, I'm trying to think of the name of the movie with George Clooney. My Brother, We're Out There.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yep. Yeah, another classic.
Yeah, yeah.
You're right.
Hey.
Sorry, just it sounded like something fell over on your end.
Oh, did it? No. I was trying to plug the computer back in so that it didn't
right.
didn't die off. Yeah, no, all good. That the same sort of thing, like it seems to be there, and I mean, I look at filmmakers like these guys and the stuff that they've done and how true they've been able to stay to their mission and their art and their ideas. Like I feel like it must be so much fun to be able to write or take a script or an idea and bring it to life the way they do in that way, and always
well they're absolute auteurs, like throughout their entire career up until fairly recently. From my understanding, I think Joel wants to continue with filmmaking, whereas Ethan wants to do like theater work now. But throughout their career, they've, you know, directed, produced, written, and even edited all of their movies together. Yeah. Like official like guild credits kind of get in the way of them getting like equal billing for some of them, but they do work together on pretty much everything, and it really.
It must have been so much fun. Like, imagine just being able to build this career and kind of do it your way the whole time. And it just goes to show that when you allow filmmakers to bring their films to fruition without meddling from anyone else, this is what you can get. You know, this is the result you can have.
Yeah. And speaking of products of untampered with genius. I have one question before we get into this, because this is probably going to take up the bulk of what I have to say about the movie. But sure. What are your views on religion?
Good question. I don't believe in God. That's probably not really answering the question, actually. I'm dodging it. I'm trying to be careful, I guess, because on one hand, I respect people's beliefs, and I would never want to belittle someone's belief. Religious belief particularly, and I get that it plays a really important role in a lot of people's lives and has in human history, but for me religion makes me cringe. The word, the idea, the concept, I'm really, for me I don't have a religion. I don't believe in an afterlife. And I think that when we die, we become compost. I'm more of the Lion King circle of life kind of thing.
But when we die, we become the grass and the antelope eat the grass. And so it continues the circle of life, you know, so that kind of thing. So that's a long-winded answer to the question, but I'm not, yeah.
All right, fair enough. Here's my answer.
Okay.
Hello, my name is Kane Noble Davies. I'm 24 years old and I am an ordained priest of the Church of Latter-day Dude, otherwise known as Dudeism.
Who ordained you?
Well, here's the thing. Internet registration certificate. Oh, it's right, not okay. That difficult to do. But at the same time...
this is like self-ordained.
Well, here's the thing. Now, a lot of what I'm going to say is going to come across like I'm, you know, mocking religious beliefs and, you know, sure. Which... Admittedly, I do like to do from time to time, but please just bear with me as I try and get into why this film basically is my religion.
Okay.
Now,
need to ask you a question now.
Yes?
Do you start the day with a white Russian?
Well, see, here's the thing. Before I quit drinking, I actually did imbibe of quite a few white Russians.
How good are they? It's like an alcoholic chocolate milkshake.
Yeah, I know, right? Well, here's the thing. I bring up Dudeism within the conversation of religion, but it's more a Western take on Eastern philosophy. It's basically Dudeism. It's basically Taoism mixed with the understanding that film can be a very spiritual experience. And, you know, being dude, basically.
are you gonna make me start calling you dude?
No, not yet, anyway. But see, and like, basically, the reason why I personally hold this film to be like, you know, that level of importance is because, like, Jeff Bridges as Jeffrey the Dude Lebowski is basically one of the few fictional characters I can genuinely say I wish I was more like. Here's the thing. You look at him and you see a slacker, someone who hasn't done that much with their life, someone who just lounges around, smokes J's, meditates, practices Tai Chi, goes bowling to relieve his stresses. But what I see, and what most Dudists see in this guy, and that's why they are Dudists, is basically a Taoist hermit. Like, he basically embodies Taoism removed from, like, elements of, like, metaphysics and, you know, like, heavy religious ritual and even, like, traditional Chinese medicine side of things. It's more just a way of approaching life. Like,
okay.
Let's look...
Wait one second. I know you're on a thing here and you're going to go and do your thing. That's great. But I need to stop and ask a quick question.
Yes?
Explain for the audience, read me, Taoism.
Okay. Put simply...
Not to be confused with Taoism, I'm sure.
Taoism is the, like, Western bastardized pronunciation Taoism.
Okay, and there Taoism you go.
It's basically, it's the ancestor to stuff like Buddhism and Confucianism and that kind of thing. And it's basically the philosophy that everything is one and the same. Like, where all matter in the universe comes from and the matter itself are the exact same thing. And the only only real tangible thing in the world is change. And that it is a lot more, well, it's a lot more advisable, I guess, to, rather than try and fight against the current that is that change, to just ebb and flow with it.
Okay.
And to help illustrate this, as Dudeism basically does at its core, let's look at the dude's place within what is essentially the non-story of this movie, because nothing really happens in it. All it really is that... All that really happens is that the dude gets dragged into an overcomplicated crime story already in progress through a case of mistaken identity, and throughout it, he's basically at the whim of people who just keep making things far more complicated than they need to be. And yeah. I'm not just talking about, like, you know, the titular Big Lebowski, who, you know, assigns him to make the mm-hmm. exchange mm-hmm. for the ransom money. No, I'm talking about people like his best friend, Walter,
yeah.
who I have seen so many people like this. The yeah. ultra, like, aggressive, so certain that they couldn't possibly be wrong, that their hubris is hilarious.
Yeah.
Like, and what's even funnier is that this guy, much like quite a few characters here, is based on a real person.
Oh, really? Namely,
the writer and director of Red Dawn, John Milius, who is even more of a gun nut than Walter is. In fact, he was actually on the board of the NRA for a time.
What?
So, which makes a bit more sense of that.
Yeah.
And when the dude is having that pillow talk with Julianne Moore's character, and he talks about being part of the Seattle Seven and stuff yep. like that.
Yep.
That is in reference to his real life inspiration, a film producer and political activist, Jeff Dowd, who was best friends with the Coens and who, you know, was a fan of white Russians, liked to be called the dude, and basically lived that Taoist lifestyle.
Okay, wow. That's hilarious.
And yeah, it's just, and like, as much as I could like point to like so many more objective reasons why this film works, like how good the comedy is, how amazing the soundtrack is, how yeah. well casted everyone is in this thing,
yeah.
like even down to Peter Stormare as well, the German nihilist / techno musicians.
That was so funny. That was that was so funny.
Stuff like that, but the thing that really gets to me is just like how much the dude just embodies that, you know, that Zen way of being. Like, all he really wants is for everyone to stop bringing him into their own bullshit, which is essentially what everyone keeps doing throughout the movie.
Yeah, well, that's what he says, you know, when he's sort of towards the beginning of the third act, and or the end of the second act, I can't remember, but when he sits down and goes, I could have just had a peed on rug. Like, I wouldn't, if I'd have just left it, if you'd have just left it there, my biggest problem right now would be that my rug's been peed on. But instead.
No, it's just even more than that. It's, if these people pissed on my rug when they thought it was someone else's rug, then none of this would have happened. Yeah. Like, if he hadn't been dragged in by people who didn't know any better, none of this would have really happened. And that is honestly kind of like the entire thesis of the movie. The notion that just like the dude is, you know, the man of his time, of his era, who just wants to live and enjoy the simpler things. And
he does get dragged in a little bit. He does get a little bit like tempted by the money. There's a few he does. He goes, the 20 grand, he goes, oh, and then the 10% fee, he goes, oh, that'd be 100 Gs, okay. Like, he's not, like, you know, 100% against this whole thing.
Yeah, but at the same time, it was Walter who suggested throwing in the ringer so they could keep even more money. He isn't completely detached from, well, he's mostly detached from material possessions, save for what he absolutely needs, which for him is basically vodka, Kahlua, half and half milk, marijuana, and running bath water. That's basically all he needs.
And
that's the other thing. That whole like tying the room together thing is a reference to feng shui,
which
we saw in Mr. Vampire, and again by the Dao's connection. And like, one of the things I really like about this movie is like, even the smaller things are a connection to the bigger idea of just, we need to chill the fuck out. We need to stop overcomplicating our own lives. We need to stop stressing ourselves out. It's shown through the one casualty of this entire, you know, over convoluted story. Donnie. And that's Donnie.
Yeah.
And he didn't even die of anything violent. He died of a heart attack.
He was scared.
Exactly, he was scared, he was overstressed, he was playing party to, you know, the film that he walked in on halfway through and didn't know the story, because he was kept out of most of what happened.
Did you notice that that even though Walter spent the whole time, the whole movie saying, shut the fuck up, Donnie, when it came to that situation and Donnie was scared, he was really protective of him and he was really trying to, like, protect not just him physically but him emotionally. He was like, it's okay, don't worry, that they're not going to hurt us, it's going to be fine, they're weak, it's all good, I'm going to look after it.
They're nihilists, like they don't believe in anything.
But like one of his like, he went into full, like, you know, war mode, like, I've got a cadet soldier here who's scared and I have to make sure, like,
And that is another part of the thing. And this is why, like, Walter is such a fascinating character, because aside from being like I think the term is Shabaskoy, which is basically the Gentile guy that gets sent out to do errands while Jewish people adhere to the Shabbos, you know, with him and his ex-wife and that whole thing. That's what that's all about.
Right.
Like the whole thing with Walter, like, he is so much in another reference to Taoism, the yang to the dude's yin, because it feels like Walter can't help but just, like, indulge in aggression, or at the very least reminiscing about aggression between the hilarious "this is what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass" scene, him pulling a gun on Smokey because he stepped over the line because he's that much of a stickler for the rules, right down to the scene at Donnie's funeral where the dude just snaps, because even at this, like, really heartfelt moment, he still can't let go of just, like, reminiscing about the aggressive times, which in a way connect to how he died in the first place. It's like, what the fuck does this have to do with Vietnam? That was such still, but we all have our limits, basically.
totally. But I think there was a lot of commentary there behind the story about, you know, yes, he's aggressive, but I think it's a bit of a commentary on what happens when you send people off to a completely futile war, and the stuff that, you know, he talks about with the invasion, they discuss, you know, the invasion of Iraq and how he thinks that's not like a real war, and all the really kind of racist stuff that he comes out with, and just, I think, you know, a comment on how when you send people off to these situations, the damage that's caused isn't just, you know, the PTSD, it's the whole mentality. There's a whole lot of stuff going on there with Walter. Like you said, he's a fascinating character, and the film wouldn't work so well if there wasn't that yang to the yin with the dude. And it's kind of sad. Like, it's a funny movie and stuff, but it's kind of sad. Like, when you look at him and how common that kind of thing is, that need to still feel that relevance after you've come home from doing something like that and your whole life just revolves around bowling and your wife who's left you and having to look after her dog and this fake Jewish thing you've got going on. Like, it's kind of sad.
It definitely is. And honestly, I have to admit, the saddest part about this movie isn't necessarily the film itself as much as, ever heard of The Big Lebowski 2?
No.
Okay, so it was a Funny or Die, like, short video that came out a few years ago. That was and it was, like, the whole joke of it was, it was Tara Reid, who played Bunny, playing every role herself. It was like a fake trailer for that. And it's considering I hold this film very close to my heart as almost like scripture in its own way, the sheer idea of taking the worst actor in this movie and making her do every role feels like heresy in its own way.
Yeah. Yep.
But, no, I but get like that.
But that's reminded me of something, and that's really funny because I was going to actually bring this up and then I forgot all about it and you just reminded me. So my film that's closest to my heart and that I've has been my favorite since childhood is The Princess Bride. And I don't know if you've heard, this is a bit of a public service announcement actually, but a whole bunch of very, very famous A-list actors have gotten together and done their own home video version of the film. And they've released it in episodic parts on a platform that I cannot remember right now. I might put in the notes for the podcast. So it's got people like Hugh Jackman in it. All doing the different the different scenes in the most famous scenes from The Princess Bride. And I watched three of the videos. Oh, Jack Black too, by the way. I watched three of the scenes today. Oh, and Common. seriously, playing Wesley, I was dying. Absolutely dying. Rob Ryan is in it as well. It's like actually the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. I was
lockdown can inspire amazing things in people.
It really did. Really did. And apparently they raised, what they did it for was they're raising money to for food for people who have lost their jobs and stuff. And anyway, it's so brilliant. So sometimes the scene would be filmed by two people separately because they're not allowed to see each other. So sometimes they were like good friends or they lived in the same, they did it together, but most of it was filmed like from one phone in one location, another phone, another location, kind of edited together. It's just seriously the funniest thing I've ever seen. And if you're a fan of The Princess Bride, don't be afraid of it because it's not like this funny thing. It's actually, these people seriously love this movie. You can see that they've put, and they just used like props from home. I mean, I don't know. Have you seen The Princess Bride?
Next episode. No. I get the feeling I will have to bring that up for an episode.
Well, anyway, there's if anyone's listening, there's the RUSs, which are the Rodents of Unusual Size. In one of the scenes, they use a corgi for the RUS. So it's very, very it's like licking her face, and I was dying. It was so funny. Anyway, so that was just a public service announcement that I thought I needed to share this with the world, and our platform of our dozens and dozens of listeners need to know about that. But I digress. Let's go back to the dude, and please give me I'm sure you've got more to say. I'll let you finish off.
All right. Well. One of the other reasons why I, you know, hold the dude as a figure in such high regard is, well, it's not just because of the way he carries out his own life with, you know, seeking pleasure in simple things, keeping things, well, tying the world together, basically. Yeah. It's the way that he's able to sort of, like, weave in and out of conversations with, like, so many different people. Like, you've got Walter, who is like such an aggressor, he considers pacifism to be a mental disorder, which sounds like a thing John Milius would have said, quite frankly. You've got Maud, the feminist, you've got Donnie, the innocent, but he is basically the innocent. Yeah. You've got the proper Big Lebowski, you know, the philanthropist who turns out to just be a mooching capitalist, but I shouldn't be redundant. You've got Tara Reid along with Jackie Treehorn as, well, basically, you know, machine fetishism, you know, the porn industry up, you know, changing with the times and stuff like this.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to lie, as someone who knows way too much about the golden age of pornography, I will never not get a kick out of seeing, like, people playing, like, porn producers talking about how they missed the days when pornos had plots.
I know, like, right? Sorry, we can't indulge in good production or storylines anymore. It's too expensive.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, it's one of those lines where, like, people, you know, out of the know will look at that and go, yeah, porno are plots, as if. Whereas people who know about the golden age know that, yes, they had plots. And some of them were even good. Like, that kind of thing. And it's and again, that plays into like the dude's way of carrying himself across, like the way that, you know, he talks about how, like, you know, I usually do that manually, like that moment as well, like he isn't in need of like other people. He likes being around other people who he can converse with, bowl with. But at the end of the day, he is, you know, self-sustaining. He is a slacker, but he isn't someone who, like, feeds off of other people. If anything, that's more accurate of the Big Lebowski than the
dude. Exactly. You're right. No, you're totally right. Look, I'm not going to say that I've been converted to dudism at all by your...
I wasn't expecting it, to be honest.
But I did enjoy that look into that side of it. I must admit, I can see how people kind of have found something in that and the way he is. It didn't kind of reach that level for me. I just enjoyed it. Really, really, really enjoyed it. I loved it. It's a great film. It's one of the best films. But I think I was a bit more distracted by Walter's character. I found that really quite an interesting commentary, and particularly because at the very end, at the very, very end, when they've scattered the ashes and
he ends up all over him.
And it ends up all over the dude who just stands there and just goes like seriously, what the fuck? Like, seriously. And Walter comes over to him and he just goes, what the fuck, dude? Like, seriously, what the fuck? And starts losing his shit. And Walter's whole body is slumped. And he just keeps saying, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, over and over. And he is. And he's finding it really difficult to deal with the death of his friend. And he knows he's completely acted like a douchebag and he's ended up getting fucking ashes all over his best mate. And for the first time in the film, he finally goes, I know, I've got a problem. Like, there's something wrong with me and I'm sorry. And
after spending the whole movie being so sure of what he thinks, yes, and being exactly wrong every single time, yeah, he finally admits, yeah, yeah, I fucked up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I loved that. I really loved that. So I think I was just a bit more, I don't know, I was kind of distracted by, come here, George, so the dog doesn't harass you. By that whole thing. And less of the dude for some reason. I don't know.
And fair enough, I guess, because like every single character in this thing is utterly fascinating. Like,
yeah, we haven't even touched on Maud. Like, her whole thing, like, what the fuck? Feminists, you know, her whole thing about, you know, people think feminists don't enjoy sex, but we do, and blah, blah, blah.
Which admittedly does fit in with like the very like retro 60s 70s aesthetic of the film, like, yeah, with the dude being connected to like the Seattle 7 and like protesting the Vietnam War back in the day, which another reason why him and Walter are a really odd couple,
yeah,
almost literally the odd couple,
yeah,
and with Julianne Moore, like I have to admit that scene of her and the dude conceiving the Little Lebowski,
yeah,
kind of like,
oh shit, go away, Mum. My mum's trying to FaceTime me, sorry.
No problem. Honestly, I'm just surprised my mother hasn't interrupted us yet. But that scene at the end, like, I initially like had a bit of a problem with it because, how to put it, there's something about tricking a dude, well, any... tricking any, you know, guy into conceiving a child just feels wrong to me.
Finally.
Like, but at least she, you know, explained it all and being like, you know, I'm not expecting you to be the dad. I just... Yeah, afterwards, which is still a bit iffy. But honestly, that's like, that's the only real like objection I really have for this. Like, that's the only bit that feels offside. Like, yeah. Everything else, even down to like Walter, like chewing out the idea of nihilism being worse than fascism, which, you know, like how to put it, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's true. Yeah, it's funny. Oh, all right. Well, I think I've said my bit. How are you going?
Yeah, I could keep going about like I've tried to stick to the, you know, the dudism angle of things, but I haven't even gotten into the commentaries on, you know, technology and the Iraq War versus the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And just Reaganomics in general. But this has probably gone on long enough, and I want to like stick to what personally means the most to me, like to the point where when I did my 100 favorite films list, like a few years ago,
yeah,
The Big Lebowski was on it.
Yeah.
But rewatching it for this, I get the feeling that I marked it way too low on the list.
Yeah, right. Move it up a few points.
Move it up a few dozen points. Yeah. This is like the kind of, you know, film wrapped philosophy that was designed for me, because like I've actually like read quite a few books on dudism, and it was so bizarre.
There are
like
books on dudism.
Oh yeah, there's the Abide Guide. There's the
Abide Guide.
the Du De Ching, which is basically the a reinterpretation of the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu, the definitive text on Taoism, incorporated with references to this movie. Like, it's a proper thing. It's like there's a lot of
work. I believe you.
And like reading up on this stuff, you know, in between like the years, you know, from viewing it once to viewing it again,
yeah,
it really felt like, wow, it was honestly like one of those experiences where I was like, I've been living this without even realizing it. It's kind of moments. And even though I originally did become an ordained, you know, dudist priest, because during the same-sex marriage debate in Australia, because from what I've read, that in certain cases, dudist priests may be able to officiate weddings.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
And I was like, you know what? Hell yeah, I'll do it for that. But nowadays, I'm a lot more into like the actual like core philosophy of the thing.
Yeah, right.
And I'm not gonna lie, I genuinely wish I was far less stressed out and worried about how overcomplicated everyone else's shit is, and just wanting to be dude.
Yeah. No, I totally get that, and I love that for you. I really, really love that for you. I think it's fucking awesome.
So yeah, this was a pretty heavy episode, admittedly.
I think that was great. I think it was really, really cool, and I really enjoyed talking to you about it. All right, let me go and sort these kids out and get sort of dinner underway and stuff, and I'll message you in. Give me 45 minutes or so, and I'll hopefully be able to chat again then, unless you're having dinner, but I can do later this evening if that works.
Not a problem. I'm more than free. Just let me know when you're ready.
Sweet. Okay, cool.
All right.
Bye.